So if I say the song Good Vibrations, you probably picture, the ultimate carefree California summer.
Oh, absolutely. It's like the masterpiece of sunshine pop.
Right, but creating that single, like, 3.5 minute illusion actually cost up to $75,000. It required this bizarre space-age electronic instrument, and it basically pushed its creator to the absolute brink of a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, the gap between that carefree lifestyle they were singing about and the incredibly intense reality they were living through, it's one of the most staggering contrasts in modern music history.
It really is. Today, we're completely shattering that endless summer illusion. We're doing a deep dive into a band that basically invented the sun-drenched American dream, the perfectly waxed surfboards and convertible cars.
But who were actually driven by immense suffocating pressure, profound avant-garde musical genius, and honestly, deeply dark personal tragedies.
Exactly. We are pulling from a comprehensive history of the Beach Boys, their albums, and specifically the undeniable genius of their Demento leader, Brian Wilson.
Yeah, our mission today is to just strip away those iconic striped shirts entirely.
We want to uncover how a literal family garage band accidentally birthed a musical revolution, somehow survived cults and internal betrayals, and managed to create some of the most complex pop music ever recorded to magnetic tape.
Okay, let's unpack this because before they were American icons, they were just kids sharing a bedroom in Hawthorne, California.
Right. So in 1961, that bedroom belonged to three brothers, Brian, Dennis, and Carl Wilson. And they were just surrounded by music, largely because their father, Murray Wilson, was this incredibly demanding presence in their lives.
Right, he played piano, didn't he?
He did. And he was actively molding them, like really pushing them toward perfection.
Mm.
So when Brian gets a reel-to-reel tape recorder for his 16th birthday, he just becomes obsessed with the mechanics of sound.
Oh, he's totally dissecting the complex jazz vocal harmonies of groups like the Four Freshmen, right? Exactly. He's listening to rhythm and blues on local radio shows, and he's figuring out how to teach his brothers to overdub their vocals. And eventually, they bring in their cousin, Mike Love, and a high school friend, Al Jardine, to round out the group.
But they didn't start out as the Beach Boys. They originally called themselves the Pendletones.
Yeah, which is a portmanteau of Pendleton, which was this brand of heavy wool shirt popular with local surfers, and the word tone for music.
And they literally wore these heavy wool jacket-like shirts to their early gigs to look the part, which is incredibly ironic considering Dennis was the only one in the entire group who actually knew how to surf.
Yeah, Dennis is the one who suggested they write songs about this local beach lifestyle that he loved. So they record some demos, and their dad, Murray, acts as their manager. He shops them around, and they actually manage to secure a record deal.
But then, when the first box of physical singles arrives at the Wilson house, the label on the vinyl doesn't say the Pendletones. The record label had completely renamed them without even picking up the phone.
I mean, imagine that. Capitol Records had just decided they were now the Beach Boys. And that wasn't even the label's first choice.
Wait, really? What was the first choice?
The executives originally wanted to call them the Surfers to directly cash in on the teenage surfing craze sweeping California. But a local promoter pointed out that name was already taken. So the Beach Boys became the official brand.
Wow. And meanwhile, Murray just seizes total managerial control of this new brand. He was tyrannical and abusive, but I mean, he did hustle. He got them their first real paying gig on New Year's Eve, 1961, making $300 to open for Ike and Tina Turner.
Right. But think about the trap that's set up.
Yeah, it's like imagine a modern tech startup. You have a group of brilliant friends who build this highly technical, complex product in their garage, right? In this case, intricate jazz-inspired vocal arrangements.
Oh, yeah, I follow you.
So they take it to an investor. And the investor says, well, the tech is great, but market data says that surfing is trending. So we are pivoting your entire corporate identity to surfing, effective immediately. Suddenly, these kids from Hawthorne who don't even surf are trapped inside this manufactured identity.
That is a perfect way to look at it. And taking that startup analogy further, imagine if the brilliant lead developer was then locked in a room and told he could only ever write code for a silly beach-themed app, when what he really wanted to build was a revolutionary artificial intelligence.
Man, that sounds suffocating.
It was. That forced branding created a massive commercial juggernaut. Capitol Records positioned them as teenage gold. They had incredible early success with albums like Surfin' USA, which literally helped launch surf music as a national craze.
But that same success built a creative prison. Brian Wilson was rapidly maturing as a songwriter and a composer. He didn't want to just write about fast cars and sandy beaches forever.
Exactly. He would spend the rest of his career trying to break out of the very box his record label and his father built for him.
But Capitol Records' absolute refusal to let them be anything other than a surf band didn't just stifle Brian creatively, it literally broke him physically.
Yeah. By 1964, the band is massive. They hit number one with I Get Around. They finally muster the courage to fire their dad, Murray, as their manager, and they are competing toe-to-toe with the British Invasion and the Beatles.
So the pressure to constantly write, produce, and tour is just monumental. And in December 1964, on a flight from Los Angeles to Houston, the machine breaks down. Brian suffers a massive panic attack.
The stress of constant road travel, composing all the original music, producing the records to perfection, and maintaining this superhuman level of output, it just crushed his nervous system.
Hours after performing on a television broadcast, he breaks down on that plane. Wait, so the main songwriter, the producer, and the creative engine of the biggest American band of the decade has a breakdown? Mm-hmm. Do they cancel the tour?
No. Brian does something completely unprecedented in music history. He quits touring entirely. The band actually hires Glen Campbell, and later Bruce Johnston, to physically replace Brian on the road so the rest of the group can keep playing shows and generating revenue.
That is wild. But this retreat from the road is the catalyst for everything that follows, right? Free from the grueling tour schedule, Brian moves entirely into the recording studio.
Yes. This is where we see the concept of the studio as an instrument truly emerge. Up until this point in pop history, a recording studio was basically just a documentary tool.
Like a band stood in a room, played their song live, and microphones just captured that performance.
Exactly. But Brian realized the magnetic tape itself was a canvas.
Let's break down how he actually used that canvas. Take vocal double tracking, for instance.
Right. It sounds highly technical, but it is a brilliant physical manipulation of tape. Brian would have the band sing a complex five-part harmony. Then he would rewind the magnetic tape and have them sing that exact same harmony over the original recording.
Because human voices can never match a previous performance perfectly, right?
Exactly. There are microscopic imperfections in timing and pitch, so layering them creates this massive choral wall of sound. He was making five guys in a room sound like a celestial choir of 50.
He uses this newfound studio isolation to pivot the band into what we now call the album era, starting with the Beach Boys today. He literally splits the album's personality in half.
Which was so innovative. Side A is full of upbeat, guitar-oriented pop songs to keep the executives at Capitol Records happy.
But Side B is entirely introspective, emotionally deep, melancholic ballads.
His isolation wasn't just a mental health retreat. It was a massive artistic leap forward. While their contemporaries were still churning out basic three-chord rock and roll, Brian was orchestrating complex emotional suites. He was leaving their surf rock peers entirely in the dust.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because Brian now has unlimited studio time, he starts working on his absolute magnum opuses. In 1966, they released Pet Sounds.
The instrumentation on this album is almost incomprehensible for a 1960s pop record. He's bringing in harpsichords, which are these classical keyboards where the strings are plucked rather than struck, giving the music a rigid Baroque texture.
And he's mixing that classical sound with bizarre found sounds. I mean, bicycle bells, dog whistles, silverware clinking, plastic water jugs being percussively slapped, and even barking dogs.
It creates an incredibly lush, textured blanket of sound that had never been heard on Top 40 radio. Pet Sounds incorporated jazz, classical, pop, and avant-garde elements.
But because it was so deeply personal, like, Brian was probing his own self-doubts and feelings of isolation rather than writing about teenage love, Capitol Records didn't know how to market it.
They really didn't. They gave it lukewarm promotion, and it was a commercial disappointment in the U.S. It only sold about 500,000 copies.
The label was so nervous about the drop in revenue that they actually pushed out a generic Best of the Beach Boys compilation just 2 months later to make up for the financial shortfall.
Which had to be a devastating blow to Brian's confidence.
Oh, for sure. But over in the U.K., the reception is the exact opposite. Pet Sounds absolutely dethrones the Beatles. It becomes a massive critical sensation.
Emboldened by that international validation, Brian pushes even further with the song Good Vibrations.
Right, and instead of a band playing a song from start to finish, imagine Brian as, like, a musical Frankenstein. He's taking a 5-second recording of a cello from one studio, a 10-second vocal sigh from a completely different studio across town, and he's physically cutting the magnetic tape with a razor blade.
It's incredible.
He is taping those tiny fragments together to build a song out of microscopic mosaic pieces. It's like shooting and editing a modern big-budget blockbuster movie out of these tiny little fragments.
Taking that Frankenstein analogy further, imagine the sheer cost and mental toll of assembling that monster. He called it a pocket symphony. He recorded those fragments across four different major studios over several months.
And the cost?
It cost an estimated $50,000 to $75,000 to construct this single track, making it the most expensive single ever recorded at the time.
And he introduces the general public to the electrotheremin on that track.
Oh, a fascinating piece of technology. It was a mechanical device that used a physical slider to control electronic sine waves, creating that eerie, sweeping, UFO-like sound in the chorus.
Using it on a number one hit, single-handedly sparked a national theremin revival and directly influenced the creation of the Moog synthesizers that would dominate the next decade of music.
What's fascinating here is the sheer ambition, followed by the tragic collapse that came immediately after. Because after Good Vibrations, Brian begins working with lyricist Van Dyke Parks on a sprawling album called Smile.
This was intended to completely surpass Pet Sounds, right?
Yeah. They were recording chanting, cowboy songs, explorations of Hawaiian music, cartoon sound effects, and music concrete.
Which is the experimental technique of taking raw recorded sounds and manipulating the tape speed to use environmental noise as a musical instrument.
Exactly. But the world never got to hear it. Smile became the most legendary unreleased album in the history of popular music.
What happened?
The dynamic at play was just toxic. Internally, Brian is experiencing intense self-doubt, heavily exacerbated by his use of psychedelic drugs. Externally, there is immense corporate resistance.
The label, and even some members of his own band, just wanted the surf hits that paid the bills. They didn't understand this deeply personal, psychedelic American symphony.
So the project dissolves in 1967. Brian gradually begins ceding his production duties, retreating further inward as his mental health declines.
As Brian retreats, the rest of the band has to step up to fill the void.
Uh-huh.
And without their creative anchor, they become entangled with some of the most terrifying external forces of the late 1960s. Wait, so how does America's Fun and the Sun Band end up tangled up with a spiritual guru and Charles Manson?
Well, the late 60s turned very dark, very quickly. Desperate for direction, the band seeks external anchors. In 1968, Mike Love arranges for the band to tour the U.S. with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the exact same spiritual guru the Beatles had famously visited in India.
A tour that turns into a complete financial catastrophe.
Oh, completely. It has been called one of the more bizarre entertainments of the era. They were playing to near-empty auditoriums. They had to cancel 24 tour dates because of terrible audience numbers, and the Maharishi abruptly withdrawing.
So they lost money.
Yeah, it lost the band an estimated $250,000. But that massive financial loss pales in comparison to who Dennis Wilson brought into the band's orbit around the same time.
This part is just mind-blowing. Dennis, the golden boy surfer of the group, literally picks up hitchhikers and ends up befriending an aspiring singer-songwriter named Charles Manson.
Their relationship lasted for several months in 1968. Manson was looking for a way into the music industry, and Dennis was looking for meaning in the rapidly changing Los Angeles counterculture.
Dennis actually bought Manson studio time at Brian's home studio, though Brian reportedly deeply disliked Manson and stayed hidden in his room.
Dennis even proposed signing Manson to the band's newly formed Brother Records label, though the deal never materialized.
But they did take one of Manson's songs. Manson wrote a track called Cease to Exist. Dennis takes the song, completely rewrites the lyrics and the musical arrangement, retitles it Never Learn Not to Love, and the Beach Boys release it as a B-side single. And Dennis deliberately omits Charles Manson's writing credit entirely.
Which sparked a terrifying fury. After Dennis altered the song and denied him the legal credit and the money, Manson was enraged. Manson's cult of followers had essentially taken over Dennis's home by this point.
That is just so scary.
It was. Dennis grew so fearful for his life that he gradually distanced himself, completely abandoning his own house to escape them. After the infamous Manson family murder shocked the world, Dennis was plunged into silent terror. He was too afraid to ever speak publicly about his association with Manson or to testify against him.
While all of this nightmare fuel is happening, their father, Murray Wilson, deals one final devastating blow to Brian's spirit. In November 1969, Murray sells Sea of Tunes, which is the entire Beach Boys publishing catalog, to an outside publishing company.
He didn't just sell the records, he sold the publishing rights.
That means he sold the underlying legal architecture of the compositions themselves. He sold the rights to the deeply personal music his sons created, meaning Brian no longer owned the very art he sacrificed his sanity to build.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this era represents the ultimate death of their California sound innocence. You have financial ruin from a spiritual guru, the darkest imaginable brush with a murderous cult, and the ultimate corporate betrayal by their own father.
It's just devastating.
It perfectly mirrors the broader, very harsh loss of innocence that the entire 1960s counterculture experienced as the decade ended. The illusion wasn't just shattered, it was destroyed.
So what does this all mean for the band as they move into the 1970s and 80s?
Hmm.
Because they don't stop touring, they incorporate, they become Brother Records Incorporated.
This raises an important question about what actually constitutes a band, because incorporating fundamentally changed what the Beach Boys were. They transitioned from an avant-garde powerhouse into a corporate entity at war with itself.
The brand became a prison all over again.
Exactly. Throughout the 70s and 80s, they realized their biggest market wasn't new music, it was nostalgia. Their older hits became incredibly popular again, and they transitioned into a heavily criticized oldies act, locked into playing the hits forever.
And strangely, they became this conservative symbol of American nostalgia. In 1983, Secretary of the Interior James Watt actually banned them from playing the Washington Monument on the 4th of July because he claimed rock bands attracted the wrong element.
But the public backlash was so fierce and public opinion was so strongly on the band side that First Lady Nancy Reagan personally invited them back to play the next year.
It's the ultimate irony for a band that once hung out with the 60s counterculture to become the officially endorsed soundtrack of conservative nostalgia.
But behind that smiling facade, the tragedy continued. Dennis tragically drowned in 1983. Carl passed away from lung cancer in 1998.
And the lawsuits began tearing the survivors apart. Mike Love eventually sues Brian Wilson for defamation and unpaid royalties, and actually wins $5 million in writing credits to massive songs like California Girls.
The band splinters into all these different touring camps. You've got Mike Love and Bruce Johnston fronting one version, Al Jardine trying to front another.
But they are all legally bound together by this corporate umbrella they created, Brother Records, Inc.
Mm.
It really forces you to ask, you know, what is a band? Is it the people? Or is it the corporate holding company? Because the original members are either gone or suing each other for millions.
The brand of the Beach Boys, you know, the striped shirts, the endless summer, it descended into bitter litigation. But the incredible irony is that Brian Wilson, the man who suffered the most under the weight of that brand, actually found redemption outside of it.
He did, didn't he?
Yeah, in the late 90s and 2000s, Brian emerged as a solo artist. He finally found the recognition he deserved, and in 2000, he went on a solo tour performing the entire Pet Sounds album live with a symphony orchestra. He found peace in the pure art of his music, completely separate from the corporate machine of the band.
For you listening, the ultimate takeaway from this deep dive is that profound, enduring art almost always comes from a place of immense pain. The simplest pop music, the songs that sound like a perfect sunny day at the beach, is rarely simple.
No, it really isn't.
It was forged in a crucible of mental anguish, tyrannical parenting, and an obsessive pursuit of perfection.
Brian Wilson once said something incredibly revealing during a rare, candid interview later in his life. He said, "My music isn't going to save the world, but I think it's going to save souls, certain people in the world. It pleases me to be able to do that."
If the Beach Boys' musical catalog was sold off by their own father, if their very name was franchised out to competing touring groups, and if the men who built those perfect harmonies were ultimately torn apart by grief and million-dollar lawsuits, does the music itself still belong to the men who made it? Or, when you strip away the striped shirts and the California illusion, does that music now belong entirely to the souls of the listeners it saved? Something to think about the next time you hear those perfect, carefree harmonies playing on the radio.